Blog Talk Radio.
Episode of The Story Blender with special guest Lane Bishop. That is who Stephen James is going to have on the show tonight. We also have to tell you that Suspense Radio will be on tomorrow for Inside Edition, and then Sunday with One-on-One. We're going to have a great show on Beyond the Cover on Monday. That is where we are going to pit Star Trek versus Star Wars. Two shows enter, one leaves the universe. Let's see who that's going to be. Let's also talk a little bit here about some cleaning up. Not really cleaning up, I guess you want to say. We're going to pay a little bit of bills. We want to let you know here's our sponsors that we want you to make sure that you visit, check out. First of all the shows here this year are brought to you by Kensington Books. Make sure you visit kensingtonbooks.com. You can check out Daniel Palmer, Constant Fear, Kevin O'Brien, The Last Victim, Lisa Jackson, Most Likely to Die, and Mary Burton with Vulnerable. It's kensingtonbooks.com. Janet Cole writes what she knows, the world of big law, lawyers, and clients. Her new book is The Mystery, The Smell of Money. In the book, she pairs a disgruntled law partner with a contract killer having a midlife crisis. They have a common client, an old woman whose ruthlessness includes her needs to kill opponents, and they meet when the killer's next target is the lawyer's daughter. Make sure you find it on Amazon or on your bookstore. Please visit Coleslaw, K-O-L-E, slaw.com for more information. Also, check out the 2015 New Mexico winner for Best Book, Robert Cadera. It's his second installment with Get Lost. Red Gold was the winner of the 2015 New Mexico Best Book, and you can visit Amazon right now to order Get Lost and Red Gold. Betty Jean Craig has a new book, and it's called Fairfield's Auction. It's the latest book in her Witherston Mystery Series. Make sure you visit Betty Jean Craig with an E.com for more information. Also, Crooked Lane Books wants you to know that if you're ready for a thrill, you got to check out their great books, including Leslie Karst and Anna Carlisle, by visiting crookedlanebooks.com. Impossible to Put Down, says best-selling author Louise Duncan, about Annabelle Lee, which is the latest book by Mike Napa. Visit Coffee and Hill Series, that's Coffey and HillSeries.com for more information. And finally, Jeffrey Deaver, Lee Child, and Suspense Magazine all agree that Hostage Taker by Stephanie Pintoff is a winner. We put Hostage Taker as one of our best books of 2015, so you can check it out now by visiting Amazon.com. So now we're going to head it over to Mr. James with his latest guest here on the Story Blender, Lane Bishop. So take it away, Stephen.
Welcome to the Story Blender. I'm Stephen James, and this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling. And today I have a co-host who is going to be joining us. He's a critically acclaimed author, Travis Thrasher. And Travis, I remember the first time I heard you introduced somewhere, they called you Travis Thrasher. So I'm glad that we have the H in there these days. But Travis has been an author and an editor. He's been involved in publishing for over 15 years. He's written more than 30 books, from love stories to supernatural thrillers, both fiction and nonfiction. He's collaborated with country music stars, filmmakers, musicians, athletes, even ministers. And he is coming from Chicago. So, Travis, I'm excited you're here.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's good to chat with you. I remember last time we spoke, I think it was at one of the conferences or so, it was, I was sad to see you go, because it was like, oh, a fellow kindred soul in terms of the literary world and stuff. So it's nice to be able to chat with you and Lane today.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, I remember kind of we hit it off, and I was like, yeah, I want to kind of get to know Travis a little bit more. So it's been neat to see over the years that we've been able to stay in touch and and grow. So, and our guest today, we have a great guest today, Lane Schefter Bishop. She has worked in Hollywood for many years and is a multi-award-winning producer and director who has received numerous accolades for her work, including an Emmy, 6 Telly Awards, DGA Fellowship Award for Episodic Television, New York Festivals Award. As the CEO of Vast Entertainment, she's intimately involved in book-to-screen programming. Her specialty is helping to sell books to filmmakers, and she's been dubbed the Book Whisperer of Hollywood. Lane has worked with Fox, ABC, Showtime, HBO, and MTV, and many more networks and production studios. And I remember meeting Lane just a couple of years ago. Maybe it was actually last year, now that I think about it, when I was visiting some producers in Hollywood. And I just loved how she was able to climb into the heart of a story to try and draw out what the essence of the story is really about. So, Lane, thank you for coming in to be on our show today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's thrilling, and I think we met up at a restaurant. Your name had been passed to me from, I think, Karen Dion.
Yes,
if I can remember right. Karen had worked with you on some projects, and I remember just how difficult it was, because you said, "Well, tell me about your projects." And I'm trying to take a 500-page book and say, "Well, here's what it's about." And I have never been good at that. People talk about the elevator speech or the log line or the pitch, and all of that. I just have no idea really how to distill my stories down like that. But I think a lot of our listeners are really interested in being able to do that. They want to sell their books to an agent, to Hollywood, to an editor, and so on. And so I know that's one of the things that you've really developed techniques for over the years. So just tell us a little bit about how you start that process of taking a story, a book, maybe a novel, moving it from book to screen, and selling it, encapsulating what the story is actually about.
Yeah, I think that the most difficult thing in the world is to figure out how to sell your own material, to be honest. I find that writers are so talented, but they can't sell their own work. It's very difficult. And that's where I come in, and I spent many years sort of developing a system for finding what is most unique about that work, because that is what you're selling. Anything that sounds like I've heard it before, I've been there before, I've seen that before, I've read that before, will never help it sell. So a lot of times authors will say to me like, oh, well, I just, you know, read out the blurb on the back of my book. And I think, oh, you're doing yourself a disservice, because it's so general, it sounds like 5 million other books, you know. It doesn't tell me what specifically is special about your particular story. And that's really the heart of it. What is it that makes me want to pick your book up off the shelf when there's 500 others in that same genre with that same type of story? Let's be honest, everything's been told before. So
yeah,
it's not like there's new things, but it's the specifics that makes it seem new.
Yeah, I think
now,
that's
I have
a really
question,
good point.
You know, right off the top of my head, because one of the things I'm fortunate to have been in the having worked in the publishing world for a long time and hearing all of them talking about that very same thing. But have you ever encountered somebody who will tell you an idea or a story that sounds absolutely so unique that it doesn't make sense? Like, you've never heard about it, and it, you know. I mean, how that's the one thing that I and many other people I've seen struggle, because it's like, well, this is the next XYZ, you know, but it's also how do you actually make it unique without making it sound bizarre?
That's such a great question. And I think it, you know, not to shameless plug here right away, but I have a book coming out that's literally about this. And it's called Sell Your Story in a Single Sentence. And I talk specifically about how to approach your material and carefully wheedle it down in a way where all the main things that you need to make it make sense are in there, but you're highlighting what's unique. So, you know, the basic questions, of course, are who is your protagonist, what do they want, and what is at stake? And those are, you know, good building blocks. But if you have those and they sound very generic, like, you know, I have a story about, you know, a woman who wants to have world peace, you know, that's lovely, but that's not going to sell your material. So you have to figure out, well, wait a minute, why is this story different from everyone else's about women who want to, you know, save the world? And make sure that those main three elements are there so it doesn't get confusing, so that people, you know, get, you know, the point of your story, but most importantly, get why it's special and different. Because everybody wants a shiny new toy in Hollywood and everywhere else. They want something new and fresh, and so that's what you have to sell.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's a good point. You know, when I'm at writers' conferences and people sort of like say, oh, can I give you my pitch or can I tell you my elevator speech? I'm like, it's not my specialty, but I'm glad to listen. And so many people start by saying, my book is about a, and I almost stop them right there. I'm like, wait a minute, don't tell me your plot because that's not going to sell your book. Tell me what
exactly
your character want. Just like what you said, like, you know, what are they struggling? What are they pursuing? And what are they trying to accomplish? Not what happens, you know, step after step. And a number of years ago, I went to Hollywood to try and sell a book series of mine featuring Patrick Bowers. And I was like, I stink at pitches. So I went in, and he was working for Endeavor at the time, this film agent. And I think Endeavor now is with William Morris or something like that.
Yes.
But yeah, so anyway, I walked in, and he introduced me, and he had his associate there or something. He said, have a seat. And then he just looked at me and said, go.
No pressure.
And I was like, well, my detective, or my FBI agent, doesn't look for means, motive, or opportunity, hates profiling, and has nothing to do with DNA. That was my pitch. And he's like, well, what the hell does he do? And I was like, glad you asked. And then I went on to explain kind of in detail the geospatial techniques that this guy uses. But my pitch, my entire pitch was just, what does he not do? And immediately he was like, well, that's what everybody does, so tell me more. And so we ended up, you know, getting it optioned with ABC Studios and so on. But it was, that was my approach. And I was thinking about, you know, that when I said, oh, you know, when I invited you on the show, Lane, it's just the idea of what makes it different, unique, but also, in that case, just telling him what the character didn't do.
Well, and sometimes that is what makes it unique, is that he's not like everybody else because of blank. I have a very diehard-like project, but what makes it different is that the protagonist, aside from being a biochemical weapons whippy-doo guy, he cannot, he's like Monk, he's like terrified, he's very superstitious of everything. So here's a guy in the most dangerous job in the world who's like got the four-leaf clover and the juju beads. And so sometimes that's what it is. It's the fact that, you know, it's Die Hard, but it's not, because that guy is so different from the Bruce Willis character. He's not your typical hero. And that's what I hear in your story, is that he's not doing what everybody else would do in that field.
Yeah, I was speaking with one director who had sold I don't know if it was a book. I think it was just a script, but anyway, it was produced. I think Selma Hayek starred in it a year or two ago. But he said, here is my pitch. It's Die Hard in a room, like in one room. And he's like, that's what sold his story. I was like, that's crazy when people tell me that. But I suppose you want it to be able to be encapsulated, like you say, Lane, in one sentence.
You know, everyone's attention span is so short these days. I mean, we're all running around crazy with our iPads, you know, and it's hard to get someone's time and attention. And I always feel like if I can't grab them in a sentence, I can't grab them.
So is the, you know, what Stephen just said with the, you know, talking about the diehard in one room or something like that, I know the cliche is, you know, it's Godfather meets whatever, you know, that sort of thing. But Is that really used often, or do people look down on that sort of thing when you're using a famous movie or a popular movie as a reference point, or is that a good thing to do?
I personally never recommend that. First of all, you're raising the bar really high.
Yeah.
You know, if you're saying it's like an Academy Award-winning movie, boy, does your project have a lot to live up to. But second of all, there's a lot of room for confusion. Are you saying that because the tone is like that? Are you saying that because the characters are similar? Why are you saying it's like Die Hard or Jaws or whatever? You know, it's hard because it doesn't give any specifics about why you're referencing that particular movie.
Yeah.
So to me, it also doesn't sell what's unique about your project, because you're saying it's like others. It's like others that did well, by the way, but it's also like someone else's project. And the last thing you want to do is be like someone else's project. You want to be your own unique project so that someone goes, wow, I've never heard anything like that. I want that.
Yeah. Well, I remember years ago I did one of that. I did the movie. It's this like this. What I did is I pitched a faith-based kind of teen YA series that ended up getting published. And the first thing I said in the proposal, the letter, was it's Pretty in Pink meets The Exorcist. And it sounds almost, I even said it was kind of ridiculous even saying that. But really, it really truly does, because I was like, in my mind, I didn't go into detail about that with them, but it was like, the John Hughes films of the 80s that I grew up loving, that vibe versus also, demonic possession movies, which I love in a strange way. So that was, that ended up working, but I also know how ridiculous that even sounded. But again, Stephen, maybe like what you did, it almost was something that was, it was a little unusual. So it sometimes does work. I don't know. That's the fascinating thing about these, trying to sell your story, though. So
yeah,
I have a question there. Sorry.
No, that's okay.
I'm rambling, Blaine. I'm sorry.
No, that's good. I was thinking Lane, I looked at some of the recent projects that you worked on. I know one was called The Duff.
Yeah.
And I didn't see that film, but I remember it being advertised. And I think when we met, you mentioned, oh, yeah, this project of ours is coming out or something like that. And I don't know if you can think back to what was your log line or what was close to the log line that you used. I mean, that's an example that some of our listeners say, oh, yeah,
gosh,
I remember that movie,
God, I wish I had known that ahead of time. I could have pulled it up.
Oh, yeah, no, that's okay. I wasn't even thinking about it until just now, but
I mean, I know that it had to do with the fact that, in the real world of movie making, which is so funny to even say that, what Hollywood typically does in these movies is the designated ugly fat friend, suddenly takes out her scrunchie and takes off her glasses and she's Miss America, And what I loved about The Duff is that she never does that. She basically gets to the moment of, if I'm The Duff, I'm going to be the best Duff there is. And that's what made me love that book, and I used some of that, I know, in the logline to sell it, because it was such a different perspective from what, again, like as you said, when you change on what they think they're going to hear, it just didn't fit the mold of every single teen movie that had come out in this arena, and that's what was so great about it.
Lane, do you feel with the whole industry, I mean, it's not just Hollywood and filmmaking, but I see it in book publishing and music, but how things have just changed so dramatically in 10 years and even 5 years, and films being difficult to be made and to make money. So what sort of things then is Hollywood in looking for? What sort of, are they looking for particular types of films?
I think the toughest to get made right now are character dramas. Miramax used to do stuff like that. Again, if you can't sell it in a sentence, you can't sell it right now. So to say it's all about this relationship and how they, coming of age or how they grow, none of that is selling right now, unfortunately. I love it in book world, but I can't sell it in movie land. You have to be able to sell it in a sentence. It has to have some element that's really unique or really high concept or really different. And it can't just be a relationship piece, a character drama, unfortunately. Other than that, there are typical standbys like foreign. If you're doing foreign pre-sales, if you're with one of those companies, they're always looking for like thrillers, because thrillers translate overseas. They travel.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So things like that. You are careful in terms of doing movies that can only play once, like holiday movies, for example.
Huh.
In TV, they're great because they drag them out every year, but in movies, not so good. But really, I mean, I do absolutely everything because, you know, different companies are all looking for different things. I tend not to do gory horror because not too many people are doing gory horror, like Saw.
Yeah.
And I tend to steer away, for the most part, from period pieces because other than limited series, which, by the way, used to be called miniseries, but same thing, no one's doing them right now. No one's doing period stuff. It's very, you know, unless you have Brad Pitt, you can't get a period piece done. So it's just, you're just fighting an uphill battle. And it's always an uphill battle anyway. So I try to stack the deck a little by not taking on things that I know are going to be even more difficult. It's the same reason why I tend to not do projects, if I can stay away from them, that are in television, that are medical or legal, or these are so saturated at these arenas, and the big boys are playing with them, Botchko and whatnot. So, you know, it doesn't do me any good to start trying to get into that arena because it's just 9 million shows like that. So, other than that, I mean, I think people look for everything. Content is king. You know, that's the beauty of what I do is that like I don't package, I don't put on talent. I just bring in the content because it stands alone if it's really good.
Now, when you evaluate, I was just thinking when you're talking through that stuff, it's like when you evaluate a story, not only looking for what's unique, but also looking for what will, you know, reach an audience today. What are some of the core like elements of the story? I know a lot of our listeners are writers, and they're always looking for, you know, that we don't want to follow the trends, but we do want to appeal to our culture. So what are you seeing right now as far as, like, emotional impact or action or, I don't know, any of the key core elements of the stories that really draw your attention?
I mean, I think right now I would say just for some reason because of the timing, things that are in the zeitgeist at the moment, that's why there are 9 million Steve Jobs movies, you know.
Yeah.
Things that are in the zeitgeist right now are very popular. I think the toughest thing is to steer away from the 18 to 35 range. It's always good to stay in the 18 to 35 range because that's what Hollywood's looking for in general. The reason that you haven't seen movies, I always get this, people at writers' conferences, oh, but I have a thing for, you know, 60-year-old women because it's an underserved market.
Right.
What is the reason that's an underserved market? Those women are not going to the box office. So so nobody wants those stories because they don't, you know, you're not going to get the widest audience possible. So, you know, things that are what we call four quadrant, where the mother would go, the father would go, and both kids would go. Where all four of them could go see that same movie, that's the widest audience possible, and that's what you're aiming for, 18 to 35, and appealing to all four of those family members in the same, you know, fell swoop, I would say. Those are the biggest ones to aim for.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I haven't looked at – oh, go ahead.
I was curious what your thoughts are in terms of just the – comic book movie craze, is that ever going to die down, do you feel?
I think as long as they make big old money, they're going to keep doing it. You know, I personally don't do them because I find it much easier to take a book that is so complex with tons to choose from and cull it down into a movie. Whereas with a comic book, it gives you so little to play with. You have to keep finding ways to add stuff in, to fill it out, to make it feel complex. And to me, that's a much more difficult task.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for example, Gone Girl, one of the Buzz books, you know, a couple years ago or so. And then that does Hollywood look for the next big Buzz book just because it's not only usually a good story, but they also know it was a runaway bestseller, so it's already going to have a following and get people into the seats.
Yes, built-in audience, very big, very,
yeah.
very, very big. One of the main questions that you'll always get, coming from book material is how many books have sold and is it a bestseller? Those questions come fast and furious and immediately. In a funny way, it's why a lot of the material that I work with is pre-publication, because I don't want to deal with those questions. Look at The Duff. The Duff wasn't a bestseller until the movie came out, and now it's a bestseller, you know, and that's how I work. I don't want to fight everyone else for the ones that are already bestsellers. I'd rather find the next bestseller.
I really love that approach. It's really interesting because that's what I have seen, too, and I've spoken with directors or others, is that's pretty much the first question instead of how good is the story or anything. It's like, how many is it sold? And I'm like,
first question,
if it sold a million copies, I wouldn't need an agent to sell.
Exactly. How many have sold and is it a bestseller? My least favorite questions on the planet.
Now, I was thinking about some of the movies. Like I say, I haven't looked at the numbers and so on, but I think some of the biggest movies are exactly the ones that you mentioned, you know, the ones that we can take our kids to. You know, you're 35 and you've got an 8-year-old, you know, daughter or something, and this movie comes out. And these movies make an extraordinary amount of money. And yet it seems like, you know, some movies will come out and I'm like, who do you expect is going to go see that movie? Like, what was this movie recently about Bad Grandpa or something like that with, like, De Niro? It's like this dirty old man. And I'm just like, who's going to go see this movie? It made no sense to me.
Yeah.
Well, and think about the YA movies. I mean, even just like Divergent and Surgeon, all of those, $388 million already. That'll tell you who's going to the movies.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. So, let's see. I was thinking about properties that you have, books that resonate with audiences. Do you find that there are different, stories that would really resonate with readers versus viewers? Or is it kind of just the core essence of good stories, through different medium?
You know what? I think it's the core of it is a good story is a good story is a good story. You know, you just adaptation is a very particular skill set. And I've learned the hard way, either you have it or you don't. So I am always on the search for screenwriters who can do that adaptation, who can turn a book into a screenplay. And it's not easy. And you have to make sure you don't piss off your readers. And you have to make sure that the things that are really, you know, important in there stay in there. The thing that makes it, you know, the heart of the book. Even with The Duff, we changed so much. But the core of it, which is, you know, the idea that labels are stupid and that if you're going to be The Duff, be the best Duff you can, those are the core elements in that book. And they're still core elements of that movie. So I think it's really about finding great material and knowing, hopefully, the right person to adapt it. Because if you don't, it can be really – there's been a lot of bad adaptations. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
go ahead, Travis.
Yeah, no, Lane, I was curious, what are your thoughts about the reverse process? And this is something I've done, and I'm doing more of doing novelizations, you know, taking the screenplay and then putting it into a novel form. And, you know, the thing I tell people when a lot of people don't seem to understand what that even is, because they'll see a movie and then they'll be like, wow, they did that based on your novel. And I'm like, actually, no, it's the reverse. You know, I wrote the novel based on the screenplay. But I tell people, and this isn't trying to be cynical, I being fairly honest, you know, it is part of the marketing of the film. And I tell them sometimes, I say, a novelization is almost like a glorified T-shirt because, you know.
I love that.
And it's not to dismiss it or downplay it, but, I mean, I've read some novelizations of, like, you know, big, big blockbuster films, and it literally is really – it's like just a few more words to the screenplay. So what are your thoughts? Do you have any particular thoughts on novelizations?
I mean, I really don't. I totally agree with you. It's a great marketing tool. I think, interestingly enough, that was easy to say, interestingly enough, these days, in a weird way, I need, even if it's getting written in tandem, I need the book ahead of time because underlying intellectual property is so valuable right now.
Yeah.
I can come in with two identical things, but if one of them has a book or even a book being written underneath, that one's going to sell before the other. It just will, because that book has so much value. I tell screenwriters all the time, look, if you don't have it based on a book, find something online that inspired you. Find an article. Find some underlying IP, or write a book proposal and tell them you're going to make a book. Any kind of underlying material will help it sell. It's ammunition.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, in novels, of course, we have internal dialogue that we can use thoughts, you know, the characters. And obviously film has other tools, you know, that we don't have as novelists. But how, when you're adapting something from a book where you might have all of that internal dialogue, the thoughts and so on, how do you take that and physicalize it so that you're not just doing a voiceover, you know, that you're taking from the book and doing the voiceover? Are there ways, are you involved with that at all as you work with your screenwriters?
Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, one of my favorite things about working with Sandra Brown when I first started in books was that she was on every call, and she was always like, oh, yeah, that's not really visual. Let me think if I can figure out a visual way for you guys to kind of incorporate that same thing. She was so good at that. You know, she understood that it was very different, that going to a visual medium from a book. We spent a lot of time working on that. I know the Duff was a big challenge because in the book, you're in her head the entire time. I mean, it's like, you know, it's all about what she thinks.
Yeah.
And obviously the movie cannot be that. And it really took Josh Kagan, who's a screenwriter, it was his take that really cemented in this movie, because he came in with filmic structure. He said, look, what if instead of it being the, you know, five layers of, you know, grief, it's the five layers of Duff, right? So you take the same five layers. You have anger and denial and, you know, whatever, the same thing, only now we're seeing it visually, all five of those stages that she's going through. And that's what made it not a book, gave it visual, and also gave it filmic structure that the book didn't have. So it was, you know, you need a really, really creative screenwriter who can go, okay, I hear what this book is saying. Now I got to figure out how to make it visual.
Do you feel that most writers that you work with, when they're in the process like that, working with you and screenwriters, do you feel like they're willing to, you know, collaborate, and are they open to new ideas, or do you feel like a lot of them resist changes to their story? I mean, how often do you get kind of the pushback of, you know, no, I don't like that, the stuff you guys are doing?
You know, I've been really lucky. The authors that I've worked with have just been amazing, and they all have been excited about the changes that are happening. And in fact, with Karen Dion right now, we changed a lot in her book, which has not even gone to publishers yet. And she was totally open and totally excited. She understood why we were making the changes. I think maybe that's what it is that I always take the time to explain why. You know, it's not just, oh, we're going to, you know, make your lead a male instead of a female. It's like, well, let me explain that we're with this studio, Universal, and they tend to like male-oriented things, and they think they have interest from, you know, Bill, whoever, Paxton. And, you know, if I can explain to them why it's happening, that seems to make a big difference, too. They understand it. I mean, a lot of the changes in the Duff are because the book is somewhat R-rated and the movie had to be PG-13. And Cody understood that, easily understood that. So, you know, a lot of the changes are made for other reasons that have nothing to do with it being visual, but a lot of them are made, you know, for a particular reason, to make something more visual for the screen. And I think authors understand that. I think they get that you can't be in someone's head on the screen. You know, there's just no way.
Yeah, I mean, people ask me, well, what if they did a movie of your book and they changed it? I'm like, they have to change it. It's a different medium. You know, it's like if they don't change it, I would be worried, because you can't tell the story in the exact same way. And, but it's a fine line that you walk, I would think, because, you know, I was just thinking of the Lord of the Rings movies and how, you know, the first movies, everyone's like, this was really faithful to the book. This was really faithful to the book. And they appealed to the fans like that. And then with the newer ones with the Hobbit movies, people are like, well, he took some liberties. And they still went to see him because of the action and stuff. But especially when you have that fan base about a book, I mean, they will rage if things aren't faithful. I know Lee Child was, you know, telling me about, you know, Tom Cruise was cast for his main character in his book, Jack Reacher. I mean, Tom Cruise is a foot shorter than Jack Reacher.
Yeah.
And Lee Child's fans went crazy. They were like, you can't have Tom Cruise. He's 6'6". You know, Jack Reacher is like this. And so, yeah.
Do you guys remember the novel?
You please a lot of you have a lot of people to please, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a huge challenge, I think.
I mean, honestly, I tend to feel that my job in the rooms when I'm in creative meetings and development meetings is specifically to represent that author.
Nice.
Because they're not there. So, you know, my whole goal is always to protect what the message of that book is, what the heart of that book is, no matter what. I never allow that message to be changed. I never allow what I feel is the core of that book to be changed. Things that don't affect that, I care less about.
Yeah, I was going to mention one of my favorite novels of all time. It's a John Irving novel called Prayer for Owen Meany. And I don't know all the details behind it, but I do know that just the novel was so dense and sprawling and would have been very difficult to put into just a two-hour film. But so the film that came out, they actually, it was so different in some ways to the novel that they ended up calling it Simon Birch. Do you guys remember that film?
Or, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and I just remember it was fascinating because it was, it had like one little element of that novel, but again, I think it is a true art form because there's some novels you read and it's like, how in the world would they make a film out of this? And, you know, again, it's there are people who are wonderful at doing that, and that's, Lane, that's your world.
Yes. It's not an easy, let me tell you, nothing in Hollywood's easy, but it's a process, and you do have a lot of people to please. You have to please, you know, the other producers, you have to please the screenwriter, you have to please the author. You know, it's a little bit of a tightrope act, you know, but I believe in working in a very transparent fashion. I let everybody know what everybody's doing, and if there's issues, we'll find out ahead of time. I don't hide anything. I let everybody know what's going on.
What are your thoughts, by the way? I was one of the many who binge-watched what's the House of Cards that just came out. And I don't typically do that, but I was like, okay, I'll go ahead and watch those. But, you know, the whole idea of, you know, Netflix and Hulu and those sort of things, and then this idea of, you know, it's almost – It's shows, but they're basically could be almost one very, very long film in some ways because you're binge watching it. What are your whole thoughts on that new development in the last kind of few years?
I love it. I love that there are all these new distribution outlets. It's
cool.
More buyers and it's more people doing creative things and willing to try to break the mold a little bit more, and I love that. I think it just gives more and more opportunities.
Yeah,
I think I was speaking with someone recently, and I can't recall who, but you were saying, you know, like different episodic shows like this that people end up binge-watching and that are released at the same time, whether it's through Netflix or Amazon, have really altered the landscape. Like True Detective was basically one crime. You know, and they were solving it over the course of the entire season. And you don't have, you know, the commercial breaks in the middle that have to happen at certain times. And so I think it's really refreshing and interesting. You know, there's this huge landscape of storytelling that's being explored through film these days and television that, I mean, it just wasn't there a decade ago at all.
Yeah, it's raising the bar for sure.
Yeah, there's earlier when we started, you mentioned the importance of the uniqueness, and I think that's such a key to what you're doing, and I don't know that it's really something that is easy for authors to do. So, like, let's just say that someone has written a crime novel, a mystery. What would be the questions that you would ask that author to try and really get to what makes that story unique? Because if you were to say what makes it unique, and may, you know, we may have some ideas in our minds, but how do you get to that core?
You know, a lot of it are the questions, obviously, that I have in my book, but it's also really that I want them to tell me, I want them to bore me to death. I want to hear the whole plot. I want to hear the A storyline. I want to hear the B storyline. I need to know all the elements, because then usually I can say to them, wait a minute, why didn't you tell me that earlier? That's really different. It's the little things that they don't think about necessarily as a big part of their story that sometimes can sell it. For example, I have a project at Disney Channel called Fringe Girl. And Fringe Girl is Mean Girls, really, for the most part. But I couldn't sell it as Mean Girls because there is Mean Girls. Why do you want to see another one? And the thing that I thought was so unique in this book is that, you know, this girl who's in high school and hates the queen bee and blah, 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 she has this history teacher who's like this curmudgeon-y kind of old guy, and he is teaching her about the principles of revolution with, you know, Napoleon and all of this. And I thought, you know, that's a cool element. That's what's different. And that's how I sold it to Disney Channel. As I said, it's this, you know, this girl who's using the principles of revolution to change the social order at her high school. That's the unique element. It's not
that's
a huge
great.
Part of the book, but that's what makes it not be Mean Girls. That's what makes it different.
That's great. I love that. I like I said, it's just not a way that I'm able to think that well. And every time I hear someone do that, whether it's make a log line or something, I was like, I'm amazed. Like, how did you do that?
Yeah.
So amazing to me. Even if we're not involved in, say, selling a script to Hollywood, very often authors do end up getting called upon to write the back cover copy of their books, or at least fix the horrible back cover copy of the books that the publisher has put out. And I mean, to be fair, a lot of publishers just have someone who has to write back cover, you know, for 100 books a year, and they don't read the books, of course. They just read maybe the first chapter or so and try to write the back cover copy based on that. And that's why they all sound the same and generic, because they're not specific. So, and then you'll have some that come out, you know, it's an inspirational romance or something, and it'll come out. She, you know, when her husband died, you know, grief invaded her heart. Will she find true love again? You know, you're just like, yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, because of the genre of your book, obviously she's going to find true love. It's just like those questions are so moot and, to me, kind of insulting to people who would read the back cover copy. But
the log line so much better. First of all, you have the answer anytime someone says to you, what's your book about? And on top of that, you put it on the top of your query letter so that if that agent, you know, likes it, they can use it to sell it to the editor, who can use it to sell it to the publisher. It will never do you wrong to have created that log line, because you're helping sell your material in every way possible.
And for you, you know, the book you have coming up, it's called Sell Your Story. I'm just curious, because I'm going to buy it.
Sell Your Story in a single sentence. It's the best.
Yes.
It teaches everyone how to do this, so I don't have to do it. I don't have to be the only one on the planet doing this. I can have other
people
doing it.
That's good. How do you have it organized? Like, is it, do you just go into different ways on how to develop that one-liner and all that, or share a little more about kind of the content?
I break it down. Yeah, it's, you know, there, it's a lot of it in the back is a workbook, literally, to practice, because it takes a lot. I try to explain to writers that you're not going to come up with a log line in 10 minutes. Sometimes it takes me weeks. It's a lot of work to do it the right way. That one I spouted off for Fringe Girl took me, you know, like 7 hours. I mean, it's not an easy process. But basically what I do is I break it down into its most basic elements. You know, who is the protagonist? And that's not an easy question. Sometimes people actually think their antagonist is the protagonist. It's crazy what I get. And what happens if you have more than one protagonist? And what happens if you have, you know, Game of Thrones, you have multiple protagonists, you know, and then, you know, what is, you know, what is their journey? What are they trying to achieve? What specifically, not the emotional journey, which is what I hear all the time, oh, you know, world peace or falling in love. What is the specific journey? What do they want? And ultimately, what is at stake? That's missing in a lot of log lines because they'll say, oh, it's a woman who wants to, you know, get the gold that was stolen. Well, why? And why do I care? I always call it the why do I care.
Yeah.
And what does it matter? You know? So there's all of that. And then I talk a lot about things that you don't want in the log line. For example, I talk about the fact that you don't want a person's name, unless they're famous, unless they're, you know, Zeus or Superman. You know, I don't need to know that her name is Stephanie. Why use up part of your one sentence with her name when that means nothing to me?
Yeah.
I don't care that she's called Stephanie. And then I talk a lot about also, you know, what do you do if you're doing a nonfiction or memoir? Because it's a very different approach to doing log lines. And I also talk about if you really feel like you don't know what the drama is, like what is the thing that's going to have the most impact, how you find it and how you creatively do a log line. I give an example about a project I have where this guy basically is leaving his wife because – he has cancer, and he doesn't want her to, you know, be part of that saga. And I really struggled with that because that's a story you've heard before many, 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 many times. And their divorce wasn't anything exciting, and there just was no drama to mine. And I was like, how the hell am I supposed to do this? And I got very creative, and I had to basically play with your expectations and say, I wish I knew the exact log line, but I don't off the top of my head, but something like, you know, a woman is you know, abandoned by her husband's new mistress or something, cancer. It's about playing with what you do have and playing with those expectations of what you think it's going to say. And I give a whole bunch of, you know, examples, of course, from my experiences, but really I'm breaking it down into its most basic, and I've tried to cover, like, every single aspect and every single part of it that I've heard over the last 5 years of talking about how to create log lines at writers' conferences. I think I've heard it all, so it's all in there. And I include a lot of workbook type practice stuff in there because I think it's not easy. It's something that you have to work at, you know. And it's definitely a process. I think I have an example in there of like 10 steps from, you know, the first one to the last one. And in reality, that was, you know, 100 steps. I just cull it down to 10 for the book, you know.
Right.
So it's quite a process to get there, but once you have that selling tool, like I can spout it off. You can say, what's that about? And I can say, oh, it's about the fact that a woman's idyllic homecoming is shattered when she finds herself the target of a coven determined to make her their 13th member. I love being able to do that.
That's good. When some people talk about maybe the log line or the pitch and so on, they sometimes get into this idea of the theme. What is the theme of your book? Do you take that into consideration at all? It seems like with the revolutionary you know, ideas, that kind of theme is kind of core to what you sold, you know, what she's learning in the class. She's changing the culture of her high school. Other than that, is that a big aspect of what you look at, or is that more inconsequential?
I really don't give that much thought, to be honest. I kind of leave the themes to the screenwriter who's going to be pitching their version in the room. For me, it's really about why, what can I use to sell this story? What's going to make it unique and different? What ammunition do I have? Is it a true story? Is it a, you know, best-selling whatever? What is the ammunition I have, and how can I make this sound unique and different so that someone's going to be interested in that material? That's kind of the core of what I do. And the other stuff, you know, themes and things to me tend to be more more general, more generic, and the log line is all about being really, really, really specific.
Is there a
a length that you typically say? You know, I've been at writers' conferences, and they're like, you need 18 to 40 words, or what, 22 words, or I don't know, all this stuff.
I always say a single sentence, and that does not mean one of those crazy things with 9 million commas and parentheses and all of that.
Yeah.
And I recommend to writers that they take $10 out of their pocket for every word. It's amazing what you can cut when every word costs you $10.
$10 for every word. That's great.
I know, kind of talking about the log line thing, but also just when it seems like every day somebody will come to me, whether it's in person or like emailing me out of the blue, and everybody has a story idea, a book idea, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. But the thing that I struggle with, and I'm becoming more and more honest, you know, when they start from the standpoint of, you know, my grandmother, dot, 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 you know, my dead grandmother who, you know, they start from a very personal, and most, I mean, you know, so many of us, that's one reason we create, you know, it's, there's a personal aspect, but, you know, how, I'm always trying to explain to them, you know, that doesn't work. I mean, like, people don't care. Like, you know, I don't say it that bluntly, but the stuff that means something to you, you know, there's a big chasm between, you know, that personal, my grandmother, and that's why I wanted to write this story, to you standing in front of somebody and giving them the log line. So do you feel like you're taking out the personal aspect of it, or are you thinking more in terms of just, you know, look, this is the best way to be able to articulate the story? I mean,
I probably am being a little Simon Cowell. I'm pretty sure I'm cutting out all the personal stuff.
Yeah.
But
that's okay.
You know, to me, if you can't sell it, what good does it do? You could have the best story on the planet, but you have to be able to sell it, you know. And it's sort of like, it's like movie makers who go and make their, you know, they scrape together all their money and get all their relatives to throw it in, and they make their fabulous movie, but they haven't any distribution. And I always think, God, you know, what are you thinking? Like,
yeah,
you need distribution first, because if no one's going to see it, what good does it do to make it?
Mm.
So I feel like, yeah, it may be harsh to say that, hey, cut out all your personal stuff, but if that's not what's going to sell it, then it's not serving you.
Yeah, good point.
Travis, you're a lot more tactful than I am. I was thinking of one writer's conference that I was at, and this lady was doing that same thing. She's like, yeah, this is a story about my 26-year-old daughter who died of cancer and all this. And I was like, okay, nobody cares about your daughter. They care about themselves. And afterwards I was like, that was so, I guess there's
like,
no way I should ever have said that. But I was like, I guess maybe I was tired or I'd been teaching all day or something. I was just like, look, nobody cares about your daughter. They just care about themselves, and they want to know how, you know, to live a better life or whatever. It was an inspirational kind of a thing, you know, how she, you know, faced her fears or something. But
that is true.
I would have said to her, you know, it's really sad. And unfortunately, there are a lot of similar sad stories out there about people who have lost their kids to cancer. What makes yours different?
Yeah.
Ah, you guys are both so good. Don't send me out to sell the 26-year-old cancer story.
Yeah.
So, well, and this has been a great conversation. I've been actually taking some notes as we talk, and
You'll be tested later.
Oh, what's that?
You'll be tested later.
Yeah, I know, probably. But I love the stuff about, you know, what makes it unique. Avoid the cliches of it's Jaws meets the Terminator or whatever.
Yep.
And, you know, there are so many stories that have been told, I mean, for thousands of years, the same kind of plot. So how do you delve into it? And I also like, too, what you said, where it was sometimes it takes hours or even days or weeks to really figure that out, especially with a big book. You know, when you're talking about hundreds of pages, it isn't just a single story, but you have to find that single nugget that makes it different.
That's right.
Yeah.
Otherwise, how are you selling it? That's my question.
Excellent. Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, I've talked to different marketing people, and they always ask me the same question: what's your brand? And then what makes this the first, best, or only? That's the other one. First, best, or only? First, best, or only? And I'm just like,
Yep.
I'm so tired of hearing you first best for all. But this is great. So, Lane, where's the best place for listeners to check out your work or find out about your latest project? And of course, your book, Sell Your Story in a Single Sentence, is already on my list. Where would you direct us to go?
Sure. It's actually in pre-sales already, so you can go on Amazon and just type in Sell Your Story in a Single Sentence and buy that sucker. And then if they want to find out more about me and what I do, they can go to VAST, which is a V-A-S-T, like a vast array of material, -entertainment.com.
Great. And Travis, I know you're always working on a new book, a new project. Do you have something coming out soon, or what's on your plate these days?
I'm working on Lord of the Rings meets Mean Girls.
Nice.
I'm just kidding. I actually, of all the different genres, I'd like to try to do something in every genre out there. And so I am actually working with somebody else on like this big epic fantasy. But, you know, the one thing to mention, talking about, you know, how is your story different? I've kind of gone the last year and a half into nonfiction writing people's stories. And it has been utterly fascinating because everybody, I think, does have a story to tell. It's just really what is truly unique about it and then how you tell it. So I'm learning to be less personal, and I think that's really impacted my work. So it's just this whole conversation we had with Lane, it's utterly fascinating, and it's still like every single day I learn something, so which is good. I'm fortunate to be able to keep telling stories. So,
and Travis, which website or Facebook page should people go to check out your books?
Just TravisThrasher.com. That's the easiest way, and then they have links and all that wonderful stuff.
Excellent. So Sell Your Story in a Single Sentence. We want people to go order it right now. And Travis Thrasher, go to his website, check out his projects and books. And I'm planning right now my next novel writing intensive, which will be in Dallas in October. It's at novelwritingintensive.com. It's all the information. We've started to take registrations for that. And for more information about our guests and to check out our other broadcasts, click to thestoryblender.com, and always remember,
the art of the story is all in the blend.
We'll see you next time.